This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So we just finished Rahatsu Shoshin here, and some of you were here for that and many of you weren't. So I'd like to sort of continue with the theme of that Shoshin and fold you, who weren't here, fold you into the Rahatsu. And so the theme of that, I don't know if they're still up, but there was some calligraphy by Giroux. Persist. Persist. What a wonderful word for our times. Persist. We can do it. You can do it. I can do it. We together can do it, and we need to persist. So I want to talk a little bit about my, I want to talk about my experience with Rahatsu around Buddha's, observing Buddha's enlightenment. I come from Illinois, Northern Illinois, and there with my first Rahatsu Sashins, it was generally bitter cold in early December, and we often had about a foot of snow on the ground, although, we flatlanders can exaggerate that a bit, but we usually have a fair amount of snow. And so those first Rahatsus, we would just hunker down in our little zendo in Evanston, Illinois, just hunker down for the week and sit. And it was just great, great Dharma practice, and it just came to take on a something special for me. And then, years pass, and I move more towards Jikoji, and I hear about the Rahatsus here, up in the mountains, sitting, silence, a week of silence, and so I had to come, and I'm here now, and I'm very, very grateful to be with you all. About that first time, about my first Rahatsu Sashin, I'd taken up a koan. And it was the 100th case in Book of Serenity, Longyas, Mountains and Rivers. When I read these lines from it, I thought, oh, this is great. This is kind of a Rahatsu koan here. I'm having a hard time. Is there a way to get more light here or no? Master wooed Shanzo of Fanyang, stop the night gathering because of the bitter cold up north there. An Indian monk arrived there flying on the clouds and exhorted him not to miss the time. Though this congregation is not large, six of them are great vessels, and their path will give shelter to humans and divines. Though this congregation is not large, six of them are great vessels, and their path will give shelters to humans divine. Persist. Persist. Carry on. Was that Bodhidharma that flew in on the clouds? Buddha? Then further on, Chan Master Kaiyu Guangzhou of Mount Longya in Shu Province was named Hui Xiao, a man from Luoyang. His father was governor of Hongyang. When his father died, he carried his casket back to Luoyang. As he was passing through Li province on the way, he climbed up to the ancient monastery on Yaoshan to behold it and pay respect. As he looked where he was going, it was just like it had been a former abode of his. Because of this, he left home and became a monk. I think, how we come to Zen is kind of like that. We may be walking down the street, we pass a Zen center, we read about it. So how would we come about it? And when we first encounter Zen, it may feel strange. But yet there's something about it, sort of speaks to us. You know, and then as we persist in this practice, as you know, we let me back up a little bit. I'm going to go back to the casket. I think when we come to it, there is a sense, you know, for some of us that we've been carrying this load that we need to set down. And it's interesting that this image of somebody carrying a casket is actually on the wheel of life and death, and the depiction of the 12 links of dependent origination is death. And the image is someone carrying a corpse on his back. And so that image, you know, is a very powerful one. You know, basically what the 12 links teaches is that in our ignorance, starting with the first link, we continually repeat these karmic patterns many of which we have inherited, and we just unconsciously, in our ignorance, continue to repeat them over and over. And then also being reified there is this sense of self. And so in this practice, when we come to it, what happens is, you know, we begin to see that all of our conditioned patterns and the five aggregates, form, feelings, perceptions, impulse, and consciousness, we begin to see, you know, the reification of our conditioned patterns, and the sense out of all of that, this sense that we humans have of saying, this is me, this is who I am, and these fixed stories. And so for me, I don't know what it was like for you when you came to Zen, but there was this sense of carrying this load around, and it was time to set it down. But it took a long time. It's a funny thing about practice, this practice we come to. Part of us, in my situation anyway, part of me said, yeah, and then part of me resisted. And I came to find out, and we'll get into this in a little bit, that's a natural thing in us, is there is a resistance to awakening. There's a resistance to giving up, to letting go of these conditioned patterns. Very, very strong resistance to letting go of this sense of I. So that little sangha and evidence, they're still persisting. I've been continuing the practice. And it's interesting how things keep circling back around. So when it was sort of sprung on me to ask if I want to give a talk today, I said, sure. And so I just naturally came back to my Rohatsu koan. It starts out, one word can cause a nation to flourish. One word can cause a nation to perish. This drug can kill and can bring people to life too. The benevolent seeing this call it benevolence. The wise seeing this call it wisdom. But tell me, where does the benefit or harm lie? Goes on. A monk asked Master Lang Ya, Xiao, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? If everything is empty, how can there be all of this? Lang Ya said, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? How can it be any different? In the second commentary, it says, seeing existence, don't take it as existent, and the existent will disintegrate of itself. Seeing something strange, don't consider it strange, and the strange will disappear of itself. The treatise on the great vehicle was written by the 14th century patriarch Nagarjuna. It says, all things must exist because of all causes and conditions. All things must not exist because of all causes and conditions. This is turning the hand over and back. Nagarjuna basically was riffing on Buddha. And then Koan's riff on that, and Dogen. This is what the Buddha had to say. By and large, the world relies on the duality of it is and it is not. But one who sees the arising of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of it is not about the world. And one who sees the ceasing of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of it is about the world. And then pairing this with the summation of the Patthikasamuppada, which is a dependent origination. This existing, that exists. This arising, that arises. This not existing, that no longer exists. This ceasing, that ceases. I'm going to pair these up a little bit more closely. By and large, this world relies on the duality of it is and it is not. But the one who sees the arising of the world as it happens with complete understanding, this existing, that exists, this arising, that arises, has no sense of it is not about the world. And one who sees the ceasing of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of, who sees the ceasing of it as it happens with complete understanding, this not existing, that no longer exists, this ceasing, that ceases, has no sense of it is about the world. So if you notice that, if you watch what your mind does with that, as you listen to those words, as you take it in, just notice what the mind does, the movement of the mind. That's what's really key in this practice, watching the movement of the mind. So Long Ya, you know, as he was carrying his father's casket, he stops, he sees the sign to the monastery and he goes to pay his respects, and there's something about it that feels familiar, feels like home. You know, and it's all this practice is basically is coming back home, coming back here. That's all you have to look. That's where you spend your time. Dogen says to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So we come and we sit. You may start a daily practice. May take some classes. And then some point in time it may get more serious for you. Then you may start coming to sesshins. And over time, these and Zen and Chan, you know, they really tie our minds in knots, reading these words, reading these koans. But basically, the knot they tie you in is this statement of non-duality by the Buddha. It is about it is and it is not. It's not rocket science. It really isn't. But there's something about us that says, oh, I can't understand this. I can't take this. I'll never be able to do this. But there is something about us, too, that says, that knows there's something essentially true about this. You know, it's in dependent origination, causes and conditions, the flow of conditions. The sameness, yes, we're all related, we're all one, we're all connected. That interdependence. And yet, the poem Sandokai tells us, we're each uniquely individual. That's the beauty of it. Now, as I get older, I like being at Sesshins, I like watching people practice. Each practicing in their own way, struggling in their own way. And then you see these glimmers of something. You see these interactions. You see it in the movement. So our left brain, our rational brain, may be saying, you'll never get it. But the other part of us is getting it. There's something happening with the sitting over time. It's happening. I often tell, excuse me for a minute. About so many years ago, I woke up to the fact that I'd been 20 years of sitting, and I go, what? What was I doing for 20 years? But something was happening. Something was happening. Because then some other stuff began to happen in my practice, and then click. It all started clicking. I'll share some of it. I think there is, I'm a therapist by my day trade. And there is this wonderful, looking at what the Western knowledge, Western information has, how it informs practice, and conversely, how practice informs that. And that's the way I look at how each informs each other. And so what I've come to realize is that, we're just organisms. Okay, we're organisms. That's it. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. Stuff coming in. System responding due to conditioned states. Certain patterns are reinforced. Some are wholesome, some aren't. Some cause suffering, some don't. We have these storylines that are generated about ourselves that says, I am this. This is who I am. I can't be any other way, or I need to be this way, and I'm not. And I'll never be able to be that way. We get trapped in our storylines. All of this conditioning goes way, way back. What was your face before your mother and father were born? It goes back for millennia. All of this stuff that confuses our seeing and understanding. I've been talking with folks from down the mountain with Bamboo in the Wind, and we've been talking about a book called Nurturing Our Humanity that looks at things through the perspective of domination and partnership. And I think it's wonderful now that, at this point in time, there are many voices that have been traditionally marginalized, suppressed, are now coming forward. People of color, women, these voices that in perspectives and understanding that have been suppressed and pushed to the side are now coming forward. It's beautiful. And it's sometimes kind of disturbing. It can disturb our system, shake us up, depending on our set of conditions. So we do what we can to shed our light on our ignorance, or what we're ignorant of. We see what keeps us separate, what this pattern of self and othering. The very Buddhism brings us back, and again, this is borne out in neuroscience, that we're just these organisms, these physical things that happen to have brains. And this is how we cause ourselves suffering. There's the existential suffering, stuff happens in life, old age, sickness, death. The world of uncertainty, impermanence, our grasping and clinging, our craving, not wanting to let go of things, our persistence in a negative way. It's a habitual clinging. And then we begin to wake up. There's this awakening that occurs. And this awakening in our practice. If we persist, it happens. What's come to me now is I'll share some lines from you. From Ben Connolly's Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara, the Buddha called himself Tathagata, or that which is thus coming and going. He described himself as merely a flowing occurrence, and the outward form that took was constant, calm, compassionate availability to people who came to him for help. A flowing occurrence. And the outward form that took was constant, calm, compassionate availability to people who came to him for help. And then there's this translation from the Song of the Jewel Mir Samadhi in the Record of Tongshan. The mind not resting in words accommodates what arises. So over time, Dogen tells us, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. But for me, that's a constant effort. That's where the persistence comes in. It's a constant. There's like layers and layers and layers falling away of conditioned states. And then I came to this sense, a different understanding about how practice we get locked up in our heads and in practice, which is natural. We need it. We need these heads in practice. But they keep us trapped, in our big brains, as Kurt Vonnegut pointed out in Galapagos, that our big brains are what got us into this trouble in the first place. So how do we begin to disconnect from that? To come into this different way of seeing. The seeing that's already there, it's there in us. That jewel mirror is there in us. It is there. It's not something outside of us. It's there. So what I'm encouraging people now is really connect with your body in your practice. Connect with the body. When you're sitting, you can start very simply by noticing when there's thinking, notice what it feels like. There's an energy to thinking. There's an energy to our emotions. And we begin to tune into that, dial into that, to what our bodies are telling us. You can actually, if you're awake to it, you can actually feel the beginning of a thought. And there is a practice. In the book Emptiness by Guy Armstrong, he has this one meditation practice where he suggests, see if you can notice the start of a thought. Then maybe see if you can notice the start of two thoughts in a row. Then maybe three thoughts in a row. But you can feel it. You can feel it in your being. It's funny how this works. I was working with a couple one night several years ago, and everything was going well in the session, right? But I can be a real sarcastic person. That's part of my conditioning. It took me a while to figure out it doesn't really help. But that's the way, that was how that came to be for me. And so in the middle of this session, I felt something coming up inside me. And I rode with it, and I was with it, and I was aware of it, and it was going to come out as a bit of Chuck sarcasm. And it wasn't going to be off color or anything, but it was just going to be sarcastic. And I just felt the energy of it, and I felt the energy in the room, and I knew that it was going to throw the energy in the room off, and I didn't say anything. I didn't repress it. This is an interesting point in practice. I didn't repress it, but I let the energy of it flow. Coming from way deep, coming up and out, and I breathed it out. That was my first experience, actually, of body awareness. I didn't know it, but it taught me something. Our experience is our teacher. Moment to moment experience. It was when we were wrapping up this morning, and somebody pointed out that Koban says, Zazen is our teacher. Our experience is our teacher. There's Zazen on the cushion, and there's Zazen throughout the day. It is our teacher, being alive to that. And this is what our practice does over time. It enlivens our awareness. I like to say it tunes us. It's tuning us. This awareness, this exquisite awareness, moment to moment, feeling the energy of each other, ourselves. The other day I noticed I was, a thought came up about somebody, and this something else came up with it, and the association, and then I go, oh, okay, how that shapes and colors. Normally we just go through life, we're bouncing along the surface. We go boom, 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 and we're not paying attention. So dropping in, drop in, moment after moment, drop in. Something's coming up, you're feeling reactivity, drop into the body. See what it tells you. See how it's coloring the moment right now. You begin to develop an ear about what's going to come out in speech, thought, action. Is this going to cause harm or not? Is this wholesome or not? There's something, the being begins to vibrate, actually. The being is alive with it once we tune into it, if we persist. I'm sort of doing, if you notice, I'm doing a rah-rah job right here, right now, to keep this persistence going for you. If you're new to it, or if you've been to it a long time, keep at it. Then eventually, there is this realization, as Long Ya says. To go back to it, there is this realization. Purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and great earth? Yes, it's all pure. It's all there. It can't be any other way. It may be pretty crappy for you in the moment, but it can't be any way other way because it's due to causes and conditions that arise right now. What we consider good and bad, it's all due to causes and conditions and a lot of ignorance. But we begin to say, well, this is it. When we look at each other, we begin to see not race, although coming back to Sandokai, we see the individual uniqueness of each other, but we see how we form each other in our minds, our storylines we have about each other. Then we begin to understand causes and conditions, understanding causes and conditions, how this came to be, that we aren't inherently this. This came due to thousands of, you know, going way, way back, causes and conditions. Then our seeing changes. I like to say in my old age, I was talking to a Dharma friend in Madison, Wisconsin recently. He's a little older than I am. And I said, you know what I'm noticing? He goes, what? And I said, life is getting really sweet. Even in these crappy times, these uncertain times, the world's heating up. We don't know for how much longer we're going to be around. COVID. Everybody really, you know, our conditioned states and our ignorance of our conditioned states at a fevered pitch. But yet, in the midst of all that, life for me is really sweet. It becomes, I hear differently. I feel differently. I'm awake differently. I'm more awake. It doesn't take much for that sweetness to come through. There's a, you know, and there's this, you know, so when this stuff is happening, there's still this question for me. Now what? Why are you here? Why are you doing this practice? Is it just for you? I remember hearing a tape recording of Suzuki Roshi one time. And he says, you know, this gentle little guy, and he says, if this practice is just for you, it's very selfish. And there was a bite in his words. Why are you here? What's this practice about? I think it's important for us to contemplate that. What's the flowering of your practice if it's just for you? I've also been reflecting on how, you know, this practice really tunes, retunes us to language and to sense of community, how the two come together. This is from the book Saved by a Poem by Kim Rosen. One of America's great poets, Stanley Kunitz, said a poet's work is not only to avoid cliches of language, but also to avoid cliches of thought and feeling. Cliches are familiar patterns of reactions that arise automatically without consciousness. Cliches are familiar patterns of reactions that arise automatically without consciousness. These habitual responses can be the cause of much suffering, because they lead to the same painful situations again and again. That's the heart of our practice, right? Waking up to that, waking up to our cliches, our cliched ways of thinking and being. As William Wordsworth said, not choice, but habit rules the unreflecting herd. Not choice, but habit rules the unreflecting herd. Because it goes underneath conventional thought, poetry can cut through these patterns, waking you up to the vibrancy of the moment. I agree with that wholeheartedly, and so does our practice. Our practice wakes you up to the vibrancy of the moment, cutting through these patterns. It wakes us up. We come really alive. And the seeing is different. Yes, as quote Dogen, basically, the start of this koan, Dogen echoes sometime later, as all things are Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, practice and birth and death, and there are Buddha and sentient beings. As the myriad things are without an abiding self, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient being, no birth and death. As no thing is, as there is no abiding self, this waking up to no abiding self, freeing ourselves from these delusions, our conditioned states, seeing into the emptiness. Emptiness is a very full thing. Coming and going, the constant flux of life. The Buddha way is basically leaping clear of the many and the one. Thus, there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. How can it be any other way? That's just the way it is, causes and conditions. Are we awake to them? Noticing how the awakening shifts things up for us. Thank you. Are there any questions?
I don't know if it's a question or not. But I don't have the language as you express it so well, but thank you for what you said. But I'm just coming up with something like, our body will teach us. And if that isn't, I'll just tell a little story.
Pardon?
I will just tell a little incident and then maybe see what that's saying. I just watched at a funeral at a cemetery one time. A boy about 10 was just grieving where his grandfather was being buried. He was just sobbing, and he had the practice of each one with a shovel would put the dirt into the for the grave. This little boy took that shovel, and that dirt flew, and he just kept at it. When he finished, he was totally different. I'm trying to view this in a way as you were describing, and if you have something to reflect on there.
Sure. You know, what we tend to do in this practice is we tend to repress. I think it's a common dynamic. My meditation instruction years ago is, I received different instructions. One was count the breath. The other one was, when you notice that your mind is wandering, come back. And that develops a sort of circular way to get around to it. That develops a one-pointed concentration. But then, you know, some years ago, you know, I was pointed in a different direction about this, about turning into our emotions, being honest with our emotions. When we turn into them and we can give them breath, give them life. And we tend to judge our emotions. Okay. And we tend to, and even in Buddhist language, there's a negativity sort of ascribe to emotions, because they generally control us. But I think that the more honest and open and curious we are about our emotions, the better we can dance with them. And this young guy was just clearly in his emotion. It came through, it moved through him, and it was done with him. I mean, the grieving probably wasn't done, but that's what needed to happen for him at that point in time. He could do that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes.
How does or can we expect practice to affect our physical health?
Well, there might be some others in the room who can speak to this a little bit better than I can, but I'll speak to my experience, okay? My experience is I listen to myself better. And there is, you know, there is, my blood pressure has gone down. But that's, you know, I still take high blood pressure medicine. But I take care of myself better. I listen to myself better. And I think the more we reduce the reactivity in our system, you know, it's, let me back up and circle around a little bit differently. You know, what happens, you know, there's this book called Inflamed. And it really talks about, again, others in the room might speak to this in a better way, but when our system is activated, there is the, you know, it activates these this inflammation process that's meant to fight off disease that might be threatening us or something else. But then it goes back down. But with, you know, in our society right now and in our lives, there's this, it's more and more constant activation. And that keeps that inflammatory process going. And then we can be, you know, be beset by any number of, you know, chronic conditions. Our practice basically is to, you know, coming back to the body, you know, we talk about shamatha and vipassana. Shamatha is calming the body, helping the system calm. And so I think, you know, for me, I, you know, my body has been under, and I keep an ear out because I'm wondering, I'm 71 years old, and my body started out with constant inflammation when it was very little. So I'm wondering when the time bomb is going to go off. But, you know, at least I came around to, you know, this understanding of taking care, really taking this practice seriously and how it helps me read this activation. I can dance with the activation. I don't repress it. Repressing the activation only intensifies it. It'll just push back. Living through your emotions, breathing into your emotions, turning into the emotions, dealing with your emotions in an honest way, giving them healthy expression, helps with that inflammation, you know, that keep the inflammation down, my sense. So that's about all I can speak to it. I hope that helps. Yes.
Thank you for your talk and your exquisite skill of speaking. And I'm curious about your reflections. Sounds like you've done that quite a lot. And the cause and effect that you seem to me to talk a lot about, and we started out inherited with These seemed like, you know, and my father, when I was with my children, the intonation in my voice sounded just like my father. So I think that's sort of what sounded like what you were, and as a therapist position, looking at or pointing out. But I have was introduced to Jung. He talked about these five affects that we don't learn. So, which means something maybe a little on the side there of inherited is something that comes with us.
And what are those?
Fear, in particular, is one I wanted to underscore. Anger, love, contempt, and the ones I like the most are joy and interest. So these come with us, but fear, in all the myriad ways in which I've noticed this, and I wanted also, when you were talking, you went like this. I want to say this. Persist, I want to say this, because one of the great ways that I seem to understand better than the more, I want to say, common speech is in poetry, as was pointed out. And there's a lot of this here, metaphorical, like water on sharp rock. Not to say too much, it gets softened. Things like that, it goes many. So anyway, coming back to this, this affects, he calls them, I think, fear and the generation of what that does with fear and how utterly important it is in our long, long history, and yet what the outcome of it with war, hostility, violence against us. And so I just wanted to direct it more to this, which is within all of us, right? So all of us is this need, this instinct, I guess, or affect.
But fear?
Fear.
We're animals.
Yeah.
So it's a basically autonomic nervous system response.
Yeah.
It's a survival response. Now, how that's conditioned is another thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Like I said, I mentioned this book earlier that I've been working with the folks at Bamboo in the Wind, Nurturing Our Humanity. Looking at life through, looking at history through the perspective of domination and partnership. And the two authors make the case that humans, for a lot long, you know, going way farther back, were tended towards partnership. And what partnership societies, cultures aren't without violence, but there's less of it, there's less stress. The domination patterns, which began to become more dominant in the last 10 to 5,000 years, they argue, is there's more violence, there's more stress, there's more fear. It becomes accentuated, and a lot of that, you know, is, you know, a lot of that energy, that domination energy, actually falls on women and children. And when you think about attachment patterns, attachment patterns starting very early in life, and they're epigenetic, actually, spanning generations, you know, we can look at that and begin to appreciate how all this conditioning has played out and what we're seeing now. And why we might be so fearful, and how that's played on and used to manipulate us from a domination perspective. So, you know, we can go on further, but it's really taking the time to, you know, appreciate, you know, causes and conditions, how we've been shaped as a human being, how we've been shaped as culture.
It's a deep question.
Yeah. Hmm?
It's a deep question. He also mentioned who, what's watching the movement of the mind.
Oh, Well, that's something you'll have to learn for yourself. But it's I'll send Doug this quote and from the Buddha about it is and it is not. Maybe you can share it. But it's just watching, you know, it's like watching the movement. You know, it's you can watch in certain situations, watch your movement to grasping on. So there's another Chuck in the room. Let's say, Chuck, you know, this is who Chuck is. And watch the movement. Watch what comes up in the association patterns. Watching the tendency of the mind to grasp and cling. Feeling it. Feeling the mind's resistance. It's a very visceral thing. Okay? That's your experience. So just simply noticing what the mind does. Where does it move? When it goes in that direction about Chuck, what are the emotions that are present? What's being activated? What old patterns are there? It's very, you know, it's that. And that's what our practice really enlivens us, that awareness, to be more aware of that, moment to moment.
Like fear.
Like fear.
I see that Laura has her hand up.
Yes. Yes, Laura.
Yes, hi, thank you. I've actually been thinking, you know, I just wanted to comment because I've been kind of reflecting on these ideas for a while now that we tend, even in the process of recognizing, as you're saying, conditioned responses, and when we're triggered or, you know, otherwise activated to an action or emotional sensibility, there is a judgment to that, that this is something we're supposed to conquer or confront or, you know, address, resolve, whatever language it is. But I've really started thinking that when we consider that part of the brain, that limbic system that is responding that way, it's a very primitive part of our brain that has no sense of nuance. It simply sees threat to the organism, and its level of threat is, in at least my experience, is generally it's a 10. Generally, it's this is a literal threat to existence. And for me, what I've been trying to practice for myself is, instead of per se being, you know, this isn't a good response, or, you know, being on the judgmental side, is to try and thank that part of my brain, to be compassionate to it, because its job is preservation of the existence of the organism. It doesn't have an agenda to harm. It doesn't have an ability to understand it. So that for me, being able to, when I have those emotions, be able to kind of talk to that part of my brain and say, thank you for looking out for me. Thank you for trying to save me. But this is more than it needs to be. And the threat is okay. It is not an imminent threat. It's an addressable threat. And kind of trying to soothe that part of my brain, I guess, instead of telling it it's bad or, you know, creating a negative connotation in my own mind. It's that really is a gift. That idea of self-preservation is really a gift that we have. But it doesn't, again, understand nuance, and that we have, the rest of our brain has that ability to understand that. So if we can exercise that compassion, maybe we can condition our systems to not be quite as reactive over time. That's it.
Thank you. So I'd like to speak to just two things there. One is the degree of awareness that's there with that. And the other is noticing the shifting relationship with ourself. As you point out, you know, this is just the way we human beings function. And I think one of the saving graces of this practice has been for me, the shift in relationship with myself, less judging, more compassionate. Thank you.
Hi, is it okay to ask a question, John? Or is there more questions?
Sure.
Thank you for your talk. Sorry. I was sitting rohatsu with you guys from home, from the beginning to end in the morning and at nights. Just before the first, you know, the session started, I come back from my mom's house, and when I was there, I run into my, I opened some boxes and I had seen an old picture of my uncle, my father's brother. I brought it back with me. I hadn't looked at it. You know, I last saw my uncle 40 some years ago when I left Iran. And I told my mom and my sister not to, my wife not to contact me during session and not to text. And so yesterday I broke the session because it was my friend's birthday. So I contacted my mom and she told me my uncle had died. So he had died at the time that I had opened, you know, on that day, he had died. So, you know, that's a coincidence. Then the second day of the session, I think it was second or third day, you did the Sandokai. Out of nowhere, this thing came to me that the box and the lead fit. Everything made sense. I was very joyous, but some voice inside me told me this is not going to last because, you know, it won't always last. And then, of course, it didn't last, but just that's another coincidence. Last time I was in Jikoji, a woman told me who just come to Jikoji for the first time, didn't know me. She came up to me and she said in a group of people that she saw me, that I'm away from my wife, that I miss my wife, that my wife misses me. And she said, she sees us back in the garden together, and we had met in the garden. So there's no explanation for any of these things. So I don't know. There's things that cause and condition explain. There's things that cause and conditions I'm beginning to see cannot explain. And, or at least for me, you know. And then what happened is I called my cousin that I hadn't talked for over a decade, my uncle's son. And I told him, your dad is gone. My dad is gone. My father died before him, his brother. This is our chance to be together again. And I wouldn't have done that had I not sat Sishi. You know, anyway, and the last thing I want to say is thank you for hearing that. And the last thing I want to say is you mentioned Pure, and you mentioned Suzuki Roshi, which I love. Often you mention Suzuki Roshi in your talks. Suzuki Roshi said something unusual about Pure. He said Pure means nothing extra. Like, you don't have to be pure, like, you know, get rid of all your defilements. It just means, like, I understood that to mean, like, not adding extra things to your judgments and stuff like that. And the last thing I want to say may be offensive to some people. I hope it's not, but this is my honest feeling. It applies to me also. Being an Iranian, being an immigrant for so many years, being away from my tradition, having rejected in some way. You talked about coming home. I see that this coming home is like returning to your ancestors in a way, making peace with your ancestors in a way also. It's not running away to some other tradition necessarily. It happens a lot in the West also, always new things. And being alienated from yourself. So there's a no self, there's also your true self. And that includes all those generations that gave rise to this. So I actually, that last one, I would really appreciate if you comment on that and your perspective on it. And thank you for your talk.
My perspective on no self and true self? I'm not sure. I don't quite understand
that
question.
Yes, that, and also this idea of coming home has multiple levels. One level is this traditional Buddhist, like you say, like tokude, or coming home, coming to your true self. But this coming home also includes others other than yourself. The things that you reject in yourself because of your ancestral patterns, you have to make peace with it, with your ancestors, I feel. You can, you know, if it's, so I was thinking of coming home in that sense, and yes, no self and true self, yes.
That's an interesting question for me. I'm sure we each have our own patterns of, you know, our ancestral conditioning. And it's a strange process. And Zen has really allowed me to appreciate the strangeness of the process, to be alive in the strangeness of the process. And, you know, I've been reading the lines recently, you know, especially in Dogen. We can't say what it's going to be, but we know when it's there, but we can't say, we can't predict. Our ideas about what it's going to be like, anything, our ideas about anything are actually fall short. So my ideas about forgiveness, my ideas about acceptance, nothing like I anticipated them to be. In fact, I didn't, you know, I thought one of the salient things that my former Zen teacher said to me when I talked about forgiveness, she goes, "What the F is that?" And so that became a koan for me. It's, you live it, you have to live it. I can't, there's nothing, you know, I can't put it in any other, we have to live into it. What I've discovered in this practice is the heart can take more than we think it can. Our hearts are very strong. Our hearts can persist. You know, we begin to realize an open heart and how strong an open heart is. And then, you know, and then there's the whole interesting dynamics of, you know, for me, of dreams and strange occurrences, like you say, seems, you know, things coming together, you know, coming together at certain times. It, you know, it's just all these weird things, but they make sense in a way. It's not what the left brain says makes sense, but the rest of us knows it makes sense. So we live into it. Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.